Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the End Credits Radio Show here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I'm your host, Adam A. Donaldson. I'm here by myself today. Everybody is on assignment in other places. And it's also reading week here on campus, so the place is just generally deserted, as people are off exploring other things. But we will roll on. End Credits is a local movie show for local movie fans. We're here every Wednesday at 2 p.m. to talk the latest in pop culture and review the newest movies. For a change this week, we're going to be doing something a little bit different. We are going to repackage three of our previous reviews into a single hour-long dedication to the Oscars from last week. As you undoubtedly heard, if you listened to last week's show, there were victories for some movies, not so much for others. We didn't review all the Oscar-nominated films. We did review more than a few of them, and this week we're going to feature three of the big winners, the movies we reviewed that became three of the big winners at the Oscars. So we're going to catch up with our review from last November of Parasite. And then we will do the review of Joker, replay that. And then to cap it all off, we will replay the review that we did of Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. And then I will be back to sign off on the show. So just go with the flow. Parasite, Joker, and Once Upon a Time in Hollywood from three previous episodes of the show. So enjoy.
그런데요.
아, 그 제시카라는 친구가 엄청 독특한 수업을 하면서 애들을 꽉 잡는다고 소문이 쫙 났답니다. 뭐 이쪽 업계에선 나름 신선한 케이스? 근데 또 그 친구 수업이 유니크하면서도 뭐 예중, 예고, 입시까지 뭐 다 커버해주는.
어머, 너무 궁금하네요. 어떤 분이실까?
만나보시겠어요? 와, 근데 이 친구 약속 잡기 되게 어렵다던데.
아, 잠깐. 제시카, 외동딸, 일리노이, 시카고. 과 선배는 김치 뭐, 그는 이사 중.
And that was a clip from Parasite. It is the new film from Bong Joon-ho, and it stars Song Kang-ho, Jang Hae-jin, Choi Wook-shik, Park So-dam, and Lee Soon-kun. South Korean is not my strong suit.
Yeah.
But this movie is great.
Okay.
I love this movie.
I didn't.
Really?
I didn't. I saw it with my dad, and no, we both... And I did not like it. I didn't get the hype for it. It's,
oh,
got, like,
dear.
It's got like 99% on Rotten Tomatoes. And yes. That just, to me, that means I don't get it. I just don't. It was...
Okay, what didn't you get?
It was just pretty boring, man.
Really?
It was just pretty lame, yeah. And what was it supposed to be? Was it, like, if it was supposed to be a black comedy, I didn't laugh once.
I was laughing.
I didn't give it a laugh. It was just regular, like, regular stuff, and not regular stuff portrayed in a comedic way, like, you know, Seinfeld or whatever.
Weird comparison, but okay.
I know. It was the first thing that popped in my head. It always is. That and it wasn't scary. I was humming that in the middle of the shower. It didn't really have any horror elements either, at least anything that really grossed me out that much, even at the end. And I really liked the underneath the house thing, but that was really out of place. It was like halfway through and then just kind of for up until the end, and you don't get to learn so much about them. But it just came out of the blue and was just really, really weird. And I want to say I thought the location was beautiful, but we've all seen Ex Machina. It's nothing special. People have houses like that in Aspen. Like, it was a beautiful look at the house, but I don't think it was anything special, even when it comes to the cinematography of it. This director made Snowpiercer, so he is very aware of the Western culture. So maybe the First Nations, Native American thing was like a play on the difference of how they view in South Korea, like how it's not in the same viewpoint yet as the States.
Mm.
But it was a little weird. It was strange, especially just all what's going on now. But that's not a negative element of the film. I just wanted to put that out there.
I took that as just like sort of, because they talk a lot about getting stuff that they have in their home from the United States.
So, just a kind of recurring joke.
It's almost kind of like a reverse cultural appropriation.
It's supposed to show that. It's supposed to show a class thing. Yeah, like in South Korea, the rich are they're the ones getting the Americans, you know?
Right.
And then, it obviously showed the main character, Kim, like at their house and the difference. And then they also showed, like, even though they're lower class, there's some that are homeless. Those were underneath the house. And, like, I get that. It showed class, you know, class is different, but that's been done in like everything deals with class, and there was nothing special in that way for it. I just want to say I thought you would like it, and that's the only reason I am focusing on the I didn't like it, but like there was some positive elements, like the location was great and everything. That one where they stay overnight, that one scene that's like an hour long, or at least it felt like it. I didn't like that at all. Where they all get drunk and that combo.
Oh.
That was just a really prolonged hang out with the family. And like, I already knew they were attached and liked the sake. And yeah, it was just, it was lame. It was cool up until the part where like the previous housemaid came back in. And then the whole other thing started. So it was like, and that whole night, all that stuff happened. And it was just too long of a ride for that scene. Or that not seen that section of the film.
I'm so disappointed right now.
Why?
Get Vince in here.
You think Vince really liked it?
I can see Vince liking this.
Yeah.
No, I disagree completely. I think that it has a lot to say that's pretty prescient right now. That's like that really is sort of like topical. One of the things I find fascinating is that there's kind of no bad guys in it. I mean, bad stuff happens and people do bad things.
They're all good.
But, you know, it's implied that the Kim family are kind of con artists. They've got street smart. But, I mean,
but
they're not bad people. They're trying. They love each other, and they're just trying to get by.
And the rich couple are actually quite nice, too.
They're super nice. I mean, yeah, there's some cultural differences, and like there's a scene where they kind of mock Mr. Kim's radish smell, and I mean, that's not.
But it also showed when it comes to that how he didn't even realize himself that his comments on the smell were bad, because he truly just didn't understand it, right? He didn't get that it was the subway smell. It was the smell of that neighborhood where there's not as much, you know, pipes being drained. There's not as much air conditioning, you know?
Right. I think it definitely escalates. That sort of lays the scenes for the end scene, or lays the foundation for the end scene. It's just like it's this innocuous comment that you could probably have with your own partner or your own friend about, you know, people you know. It's just like, oh, yeah, he's a great guy, but, you know, he kind of smells funny.
It showed positive elements of all the
classes. But it's the seed that's planted that, you know, when this thing bursts open at the end, when like all sort of the fracture lines between the classes are sort of like erupt in this one climax, you see it grow. It grows from that little thing, that one little line, and it gets reinforced and reinforced and reinforced until you see the father, Mr. Kim, Ki-taek, do what he does at the end.
Yeah.
And there's so much of this here. I love the. I didn't really know a lot about the movie going in, so
yeah, I didn't either.
I loved the first hour or so when they're like infiltrating the park house.
I was entranced for like the first hour,
okay,
and then I started snoring.
Okay,
it was like 2 hours, over 2 hours.
Yeah, I was there too, but
yeah, I'm curious if we went the same night. But
I it was full house. I went Friday. Did you go Friday?
Yeah, Friday. Okay. Yeah,
but it was a full
house. I think I might have heard your laugh.
Oh, okay. There you go. But no, I was entranced too, because I'm like, this is going to go bad at some point. They are going to be found out at some point. And there's a scene where the little park boy is like smelling them. And it's like, you guys all smell the same. Actually, that's another little seed that I just put that together.
What?
That's when the boy is, because that's before they're over here.
The boy's comment. Yeah,
the boy says they all smell the same. Yeah. So, I mean, there's another little seed planted along the way. And I'm like, okay.
The smelling element was the only class one that I did think was really well done.
And my thought is like, is the boy going to blow this over?
Yeah.
And then, you know, the parks go for camping. And the old housekeeper comes back, and then you certain things are revealed mm-hmm. that are underneath the house that they didn't know that was there. And I was enthralled by that scene because I didn't know where it was going. Like, where does this go now? Like, oh. I knew it was going to blow up, but, like, it adds this other level of, like, now there's this whole new secret and of somebody living under the house that's connected to the housemate. And then, the classism it talks about here, where it becomes about the old housemaid and her husband against the family
yeah.
and how they are in this beautiful home none of them will mm-hmm. ever be able to acquire, but have at various points managed to, like, become a part of the household.
Mm-hmm.
But they've pitted themselves against each other.
Well, I think
I think
a third party also just kind of right. Wanted to show that, you know, class isn't just black and white, right?
Yeah, no, it's funny how it turns when you see the old housekeeper, like, pleading with the mom, Mrs. Kim, about, like, please, like, just bring some food down here to my husband, and, you know, like, be my sister, be my mm-hmm. friend, do me this solid. And then she discovers the rest of the family, and then it turns and she's like, oh, you're a scum. And even though I've been hiding my husband in this house where I've been the housekeeper for years, now you're the scum because you're doing a con too. And then it pits them against each other, and it is at once, like, horrific
mm-hmm.
and it's once, like, you feel pity for everyone because it's like, you guys are in the same boat. Like, can't you see you're in the same boat?
Yeah. I don't know. I wasn't engrossed enough to feel too
I felt
the feeling of how I should feel bad for them. I was like, if this was real life, I'd feel bad for them.
Mm.
But the film didn't entrance me enough for me to actually, you know, neurologically emit those emotions.
No, the focus isn't new, but I much rather appreciate Bong Joon-ho's touch here. Letting you discover things as you talk about
yeah.
them. That's like, I didn't have that feeling with the Joker. And he's really great at creating a sense of place. Him and Wes Anderson are really great filmmakers when it comes to, like, sets and setting and like the geography of places. And you
yeah.
see that in Snowpiercer as they move up the train. And you see that here too with where the Kims live, where it's this, like, subterranean basement thing where the toilet is, like, paradoxically, like, a couple of feet under the ceiling.
Yeah.
And then, you know, there's the shot where the son, Ki-tak, is going to the interview to be the tutor, and it's literally him, like, right, he first of all, he has to leave the basement apartment
mm-hmm.
and then the going up to the house is, like, literally uphill, and he comes up the hill and it's, like, right behind him, and he's, like, coming up into the light, and it's such simple staging, such simple cinematic language, and it's still very, very effective.
I guess. I don't know. I think it was just simple. I honestly think it's just because South Korea is pretty beautiful. It's got a lot of beautiful trees, and it's got a lot of beautiful, sidewalks that are, you know, very well-made kind. I don't think there was anything special when it comes to the filters of it. It was just pretty plain Jane when it comes to that, like the color filterization of it. And, yeah, the shots were just normal, and not the beautiful kind of normal that I mentioned when it comes to Richard Linklater. Yes, it made the South Korean area look real, but it didn't make it look like a beautiful kind of
image
that is as real.
I thought.
I know it's hard to understand, but
I thought it was. I mean,
no. I thought it was really great. Well done. I just don't think it was anything special. Again, I think the cinematography of the same kind of pad in Ex Machina was also better.
No, I don't think it's anything special. I think it's very basic. But you can use basic in a way that really lets you feel the story as much as sort of
yeah.
being told the story. And I think that's what Bong Joon-ho gets really, really right here, is
okay.
that he uses it. It really is a film class.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this probably will be looked at in film class into, like, how you can use the camera to tell the story along with the character and along with set and along with dialogue. It's really
I'll tell you one thing,
engaging on that level.
No film prof in Guelph's going to. I know that as a fact. I apologize.
Fair enough. but yeah, I really felt impacted by
everybody did in the packed theater. I know I felt out of place, but I think my reasonings are justifiable.
Mm-hmm.
But I also want to say I want Bookshelf to start playing more South Korean films. They used to play a lot of, well, they still do a lot of Japanese ones. Samurai ones from the, I think, the 50s. They won a beautiful trilogy. Kurosawa and the one that was like a real whoppy one about, sorry, not wacky one about sushi, but they don't play enough South Korean films. And that's a kind of film I want to see more. I see Chinese films a lot too as well, but yeah. So I was honored with Bookshelf doing that.
Well, way to dodge having to talk about the movie some more.
Yeah. Well, no, hey, what? Yeah. Oh, I also thought the ending was a little lame. That was like a Hallmark kind of. It was like a Hallmark kind of ending, but they had like the best Hallmark writer in the office.
I'm on the fence about the ending. When it started going like the. That way, when he says, like, I will buy that house and we will be able to... And you sort of see this, it's implied it's like a flash forward of
cool.
Ki-Taq buying the house. And then it goes back to him, the camera literally pans down.
Yeah.
And he's still sitting in the basement. And it's like, okay, message received. Because there's a scene where they're in the shelter during the flooding. And he says to his dad... Okay, Dad, what's the plan? What's the plan?
Yeah.
And Ki-Taq says, there is no plan. Because, like, everybody in here had a plan, and the plan went to blank.
Yeah.
And so, like, there's no point in planning anything. And then here you are again. You have Ki-Woo, again, like, making the same mistakes. He's, you know, he's the one, I'm going to... go to university, I'm going to get a great career, I'm going to be rich, and then I'm going to buy that house. And it's the same thing. It's like...
So, which is important. It's an unfortunate truth.
It goes back to the whole social thing where, you know, people... This is what you're kind of fed in a capitalist society like ours. It's like, yeah, if you do up your bootstraps, if you work hard, keep your head down, you know, work 60 hours a week.
Yeah, because you can go
take whatever job.
Poor
you
rich,
will eventually become rich.
Yeah.
You're not poor. You're temporarily not rich.
Yeah, and that's something that is expressed a lot in
and
films.
In spite of everything, Ki-Woo still thinks that, despite the lesson his father like tried to. It's like, you can plan all you want. You will still end up in a basement in a high school gym because your apartment, your basement apartment flooded in a monsoon.
Yeah. Oh, well, and how it is harder for the lower class to get into a lot of things that are easier for the higher class. Like
so
the,
it just that really kind of reinforced me the message of how like these poor people are basically kind of pongs in the system. Like they don't even get really punished for the perpetrating the con that they do. I mean, they do in a sense that half the family is gone. But in terms of like not going to jail or anything, it's like they're almost like not worth putting in jail.
Well, because all the son and the mom did was the con. They didn't take part in any of the other stuff.
But I mean, you can make an argument for like accessory. I don't know how
the legal
system works in South Korea versus North America, but it feels at the end it's like they're not even worth putting in jail.
Yeah. No, and I still just the look upon class was a pinch better than other films. But everything else was not. It was – no, I was going to make a fart sound. That'd be rude. No, it was – I just wasn't a huge fan.
I am a huge fan. I could see
it
again.
I know, 99% on the 1%. Not the fun elite 1%. I'm the the 1% most people are going to disagree with.
What a great message to leave this on. I am the 1%. All right,
but I do want to say I know I can see why you loved it, and I do think people who agree with you more on the end credits episode should go watch it. If you're a Peter fan, though,
if you're a Peter
maybe
fan.
Give me a listen.
All right, yeah? We'll see who's right in the end. I think it'll be me, but that's fine.
Arthur, I have some bad news for you. This is the last time we'll be meeting.
You don't listen, do you? You just ask the same questions every week. How's your job? Are you having any negative thoughts? All I have are negative thoughts.
And finally, in a world where everyone thinks they can do my job, check out this guy.
When I was a little boy and told people I was gonna be a comedian, everyone laughed at me. Well, no one's laughing now.
You can say that again, pal.
And that was a clip from Joker. It is the new film from Todd Phillips, and it stars Joaquin Phoenix, Zazie Beetz, Francis Conroy, Brett Cullen, Glenn Fleischler, and Robert De Niro. And it's gotten a lot of controversy, a lot of concern in the United States, you know, police officers at theaters and all that. I wish the controversy was over a better movie, though.
Yeah, this movie, I'm kind of glad you said that, but I was kind of wishing maybe you liked it, and then we'd have a real real Siskel and Ebert debate here or something.
Right.
But this, like, I wrote down, this, I just wrote Joker, flaming turd of a movie. That's all I wrote down. Man, I can't believe, it was just so dismal to have to sit through that for 2 hours.
Yeah.
It was just like... like, give me something here. Give me, like, some light to it or something. Like, I must say that Joaquin Phoenix, yes, he's an excellent actor. He probably did what he was meant to do in the role.
Right.
He did the method acting. He went for it in all the limitations that were imposed on him. And it's just a horrible, dismal movie I found where there's, like, no light to it. You see who the influences are. And I really like Todd Phillips when he's done comedies. Like, The Hangover is, I think, one of the funniest movies. I really like Old School. And now he's crossing over, but he's not quite Jon Favreau right now crossing over from
Gunny. Right.
And I just thought it was way too dismal. And you can see his influences were like, and obviously as Robert De Niro in the movie,
yeah.
His influences are Taxi Driver and King of Comedy, basically. Mm-hmm. So Joaquin, the Joker, is kind of like an amalgamation of like Travis Bickle and Rupert Pupkin.
Right.
Travis Pupkin, I guess. But
that would have been two on the nose.
but those were like two much better movies. It's like, it was such a weird movie in that he has all these 70s influences and trying to make it gritty, and then there's just nothing to it. It's just this character having like a mental breakdown for 2 hours with no, I don't know, there's no light to it. Like, at least Taxi Driver had Jodie Foster in it, you know? It had had something to it, you know, some light to it.
There was a redeeming character.
Redeeming characters. Yeah. Whereas...
yeah, I think I liked it better than you, but I think it's cleverer than it thinks it is, or yeah. It's cleverer than it is, I should say. It thinks it's cleverer than it is, I guess, is what I'm trying to get at. It's from sort of reading some of the comments people post about online, I think it's one of those movies that makes people who don't see very many movies feel like they're cinephiles, because, ooh, it's like, ooh, that was inspired by Taxi Driver. It's like, yeah, tell me something I don't know.
Yeah.
But it's I would agree with Joaquin Phoenix. I think it is a showcase for him.
Yeah.
He has wonderful physicality in it. There's like so many scenes where it's like you see his gauntness and his thinness, and there's a scene where it's like he's clearly having some sort of, I don't want to say fit, but because that there's kind of a negative connotation because the character does suffer from mental illness, but like he's clearly suffering, having some kind of episode after he's attacked by some hoodlums who steal his sign because he's a clown who does this, like, the sign twirling and things. Mm-hmm. And he's clearly like having some sort of episode, and you see him just like hunched over, and you see the spine protruding from the back, and you hear like he's clearly like got something in his hands that he's like twisting and turning, and you hear the rubber, and it's like almost like nails on a chalkboard. You just like feel his suffering, and he doesn't have to say anything at all. It's just, it's there, it's pervasive. And then if that was the movie they wanted to make, okay. But there's like there's so many things that it feels like it's trying to get at. There's bits of Anonymous because, you know, the Joker or the Arthur Fleck character who, quote unquote, becomes the Joker ends up inspiring this movement of, you know, people who wear clown masks and get into civil disobedience. So there's an Anonymous aspect. There's an Antifa aspect. There's elements of like incel and alt-right culture. And but at the same time, it's like, no, he's got mental illness and it's like super serious, guys. Like he was abused. And and it's just like, no, it's too much. You need to like sort of, it's one thing to sort of hint at things and to present a complex picture, but Todd Phillips, you're throwing spaghetti at the wall and going, art! Do you see art? That's art!
Yeah.
And it's like, well, is it?
Yeah. No, the one, and it would have been better if it was just sort of like an origin third of a movie or something, you know? And then it got into him as the Joker, but it was just pretty much, it's all just origin, him just in this most dismal, depressing state for like 2 hours.
Yeah.
And then you see at the end, he's kind of free of it in this really crazy way because now he's like
it's very confused.
Celebrity in a way.
Yeah, it's very confused about the character. Because in the comic books, and The Dark Knight touches on this a lot, that Joker is an aberration amongst the criminals in that he just does things because as the Michael Caine, Alfred points out, like, some people just want to watch the world burn.
Mm-hmm.
Well, those people don't create a movement.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they're not movement people.
Yeah.
And there was some of this on the TV show Gotham, too, that Joker kind of creates a movement of people willing to indulge in their craziest aspects. It's like, no, that's not what the character is about. The character, even in Gotham City, which is filled with people who dress up as penguins and people who dress up as, you know, Mr. Freezes and, you know, clay faces and two faces and all those people have a point. Like, there's a reason why they're criminals. Like, Mr. Freeze is trying to save his wife. You know, the penguin's been mocked all his life, so he's trying to, you know, become the most powerful guy. The Riddler has issues and Two-Face, like, has a psychological break. And the Joker is just the Joker.
Mm-hmm.
And to try and like cram 13 different explanations for why he does what he does and then on top of it make a social movement just makes no sense at all.
Mm-hmm.
And if you wanted to tell the story about how somebody goes so wrong, they just become a killer in clown face, okay. But the whole social movement aspect and inspiring others, it's very clearly based on like 1970s New York, 1980s New York, which was a powder keg, which was a sort of the height of urban decay.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, there was also no movement at the time. You know, people sort of suffered in the decay, and it you know, it took a while to come out of it. And so it's just he doesn't really seem to know what he's trying to say.
And that's what, you know, Taxi Driver hit her on the nose in the 70s, that decay.
Yeah.
And he's taken
filmed amongst it too.
Yeah, and he's taken elements of it. Like Joaquin Phoenix does it. I think does a credible job, but he's trying to be like Robert De Niro. I think that's, you know, that method actor in Taxi Driver.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the film, like I said, there's no, like you said, no redeeming character. There's no Jodie Foster. Yet it's like if you go back to Taxi Driver, he had a couple creepy friends or whatever coworkers in the. Who worked as cab drivers as well. In this, he's a clown. There's these couple creepy clowns that are in it. And it just adds nothing to the film that these people, you know, it kind of shows that he's being bullied at work a little bit by this.
Yeah.
But it's just, it just doesn't add any light or dimension or anything to it. You know, it's just sort of, just a really depressing way to look at the world. And yeah, like you said, in the 70s in New York, maybe it was depressing, but there's a lot of people who've made movies and you leave them and you feel like exhilarated, even though it's depressing, you know, or you leave feeling like, okay, I've seen, like you said, a great work of art, not somebody just throwing crap at the wall kind of thing.
Right? Yeah, it just like, I can live through like depressing. I saw Midsommar earlier this year. I can, you know, but you know, what are you trying to tell me? And I think that's where this film falls is like, are you trying to tell me it's like, okay to exploit people who are mentally ill and people who are abused as long as you can, like, staple your message on top of them. And because, I mean, the film makes a point that, that Arthur Fleck, the Phoenix character, he says, like, oh, I'm not here to make a political statement. And then he makes a political statement. And it's, you know, so what, you know, what are you trying to say, Todd Phillips? And I think that he's been very abrasive in terms of how people have reacted, in terms of, like, the critical reaction some people have had. And you know, him going off the cuff, like, well, I can't make comedies anymore because of woke culture. And it's like, well, you can't really make dramas for the same reason.
He's in a real bad place, right?
Right. You know, you're stuck. So it feels like you're sort of raging against the machine yourself, and you sort of latch onto the Joker as, like, as an expression of that. And it's like, well, the Joker isn't the raging against the machine. The Joker is just a rage machine. And it just feels like it's not that there's not anything redeeming. Although, you know, maybe something like The Warriors, like The Warriors isn't particularly redeeming either. But I think that's another inspiration here. Although, you know, they get to the end, they get to Staten Island and they sort of look at the sunrise and it's kind of like, oh, we survived one more night in this squalid hellhole. There's not even that moment. And it gets to the end and there's been this question of, I actually like the idea that maybe Thomas Wayne was an a-hole.
Yeah.
Was kind of like, you know, an amoral jerk of an a-hole, and that, you know, sort of because he's killed and, you know, him and his wife are killed in a back alley and they leave a young son to grow up orphaned, that, you know, maybe there's a bit of a martyr complex there. But I think that I can't even remember what the point I was trying to get out going into that direction, but it's trying to enjoy, like, sort of being able to try and undermine the text while still playing into the text too. And this is what I was trying to get at too, is this idea that how much of this is in his head. And we find out that he has this whole relationship with a neighbor played by Zazie Beetz, and that was, like, kind of in his head, and that's kind of revealed, like, near the end of the movie, that all these, like, cool times he's had with her were in his head. And so that all we're left with is, I think, in terms of, like, the real interactions he's had with her are, like, a brief encounter they have in an elevator where they ride in the elevator together, and then a scene where he's stalking her.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah.
and
you can kind of see that coming, but it is, I guess, it is kind of interesting the way that's revealed.
Right.
At the same time, I guess I'm going back, I get being kind of a film snob in a way, because I've seen Taxi Driver multiple times. Like, the whole thing with putting his fingers up to his head, that's like the end of Taxi Driver, right? It's just like, trying to be such an homage to it, but I think, like you said, it misses the point of, you know, where is this man in the culture he's in? Like, Travis Bickle, almost a political assassin, he's trying to navigate his way through, he's doing stuff randomly, and you're saying, like, the Joker's a random character.
Yeah.
You know, why does it fit so neatly in this box at the end where it's like, okay, it's a movement now?
And yeah.
I don't know. It seemed to me to be like 2 hours of my life I'll never get back in a way, you know? But I could see other people maybe liking it because of the performance by Joaquin Phoenix, but it just doesn't, I don't think it amounts to anything. Like,
no, I don't think it amounts to anything. I don't know how anyone, I mean, we shouldn't sort of limit our imagination. I'm not sure how this would inspire anyone to do anything other than to, you know, maybe go and watch Taxi Driver. But there's so much to it too that it's just like, how much of it is in his head? And then we come to the end and it's kind of like, it asks the explicit question. And I found Ad Astra, which was another kind of disappointment for me, does that too, where it's like, we can't let the subtext lie. We have to make it text. We have to make it explicit. Was this all in his head from, like, the first minute you see him at the beginning of the movie till this moment right here, 2 minutes before the credits roll? Mm-hmm. Is it all in his head? Maybe.
Oh, yeah.
And Ad Astra did that too, where it's like, it's okay to leave stuff nebulous. It's okay to make us ask the question, like, is he imagining this?
Yeah.
But I don't need you to, you know, tilt my head over to the next frame and go, see, he is maybe imagining this. I don't need you to guide me by the hand. And I feel like there's just not enough confidence here to just sort of let the thing, because Taxi Driver also ends on a very nebulous note too, where mm-hmm. you're not exactly sure how much of this was mm-hmm. in Travis Bickle's head. And it's just, you got to let us think for ourselves. The whole point of this thing is like, kind of like think for yourself. It's a controversial movie, but you can decide for yourself to see it. And then at the end, it's like, well, we can't really let you decide for yourself because we're blatantly walking you up to the line.
Yeah, and I think at the start there made a good point about like so much of the press on this film is about, okay, there's you know, there's danger, there could be shootings, there's like, you know, this could inspire
who knows,
lone terrorists who are going to do something. And like I'm saying, afterwards, I just, I don't know who, like who's this, it's not going to inspire anybody. It's just a really bad movie that's trying to say something, but doesn't really know what it's trying to say.
Yeah.
And it's just, I don't know. And for like an origin movie for a character like Joker, it kind of misses the mark, I think, because like why just make a 2-hour movie that's just leads nowhere basically about this character,
right? You
know, I think, like I said before, it'd be better if the origin part, you know, have 15 minutes of this or something, and then it leads into a movie with the Joker in present day.
I think the idea is sound. Like, can you recontextualize like a character like the Joker and try and tell something serious with that character? This is not that movie.
Eyes black as coal, and when he lifts his face, every hair in the place is on him. Starting soft and slow.
Just put them in the wardrobe, all right? What's it gonna hurt? Then if you need them, you got them, all right?
And then they gotta have a conversation with that wardrobe assistant, and man, she's a bitch. I just don't, right, please.
Look, Randy, I'm asking you to help me out, man. If the answer is no, the answer is no. Not no with excuses.
Hey, man, this ain't a Andy McLaughlin picture, you know? And I can't afford to hire a bunch of guys that smoke cigarettes and sit around talking to each other all day on the chance that I might use them.
I got a 4-man team here, Rick. If I need more than that, I got to get it approved. And, you know, I got to look after my dudes.
Hey, and if your dudes were a better match for me, I'd say, oh, okay, you got me. But that's not the case, and you know it. He's a great match for
me. Yeah,
no. Hey, you could do anything you want to him. Throw him off a building, right? Light him on fire. Hit him with a... Lincoln, right? Get creative. Do whatever you want. He's just happy for the opportunity.
Rick?
Yeah.
I don't dig him.
And that is a clip from Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. It's a new film from Quentin Tarantino, and it stars Leonardo DiCaprio, Brad Pitt, Margot Robbie, Emile Hirsch, Margaret Qualley, and Al Pacino, and Kurt Russell, who is in that clip. So much going on in this movie, but I also feel like, much the same way, although I'm not as big a fan of Hateful Eight, with that and Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, there does seem to be a thing with Quentin Tarantino now where he's thinking more linearly,
mm-hmm.
yeah. where it's not jumping around from like story point to story point. There were no, you know, chapter titles.
Yeah.
It's very, I want to say, focused, although it's not terribly focused at times. There's these long languishing parts where he enjoys like the filmmaking process of watching Leonardo DiCaprio as Rick Dalton making this Western pilot.
Yeah, he gets into the weeds quite a bit.
Yeah.
I would say he's self-indulgent in this.
Oh, absolutely.
Like those are the first words that come to mind, but not always in an entertaining way.
Mm.
I would say it's almost in a boring way for much of the film, for me.
Oh, okay.
That was my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
But there are some great scenes. It just seems at like 2 hours and 41 minutes, I think he could have cut a lot out and made it more, have more energy. Just the film have more energy. And I just felt like he went down some rabbit holes sometimes where about the whole filmmaking process and the bounty law and the FBI show and all these shows from the past that it's just, you know, it's kind of fun watching because he has such passion for it. And it's something made from his childhood or he looks back with rose-colored glasses to these films. But I think it dragged a lot, this film. And I think it could have been under 2 hours and been much more effective. And, you know, it's not a shame to have something under 2 hours for him. But I think it's he's almost in a corner because it's like when you're marketing a Quentin Tarantino film, it's going to be epic. It's going to be 2 hours 20, 2.5 hours. And I just felt like with this, I didn't hate it, but I actually kind of disliked it until the end. When it goes gonzo and then it's self-indulgent in an entertaining way.
Let's just say it goes off the history book. Actually, I didn't find it long at all. Although, I mean, I can see how people would. I actually found the time kind of flew by. I guess because there's this kind of dreamlike quality. And I guess what you said, it's like he loves this time period. The movies he loves is from like the late 60s, early 70s time period. The music he loves is from this time period. And there are all these shots of just like people just driving around LA and looking at all these landmarks and all these old advertisements and listening to the radio and and hearing like all this old music and commercials for, you know, the Illustrated Man in theaters now. And it just...
There's lots of shots of feet too.
I mean, that if you want to talk about self-indulgent, and like particularly when it's like Margaret Qualley's turn and she's like 24 and Tarantino's like 56 and it's like, okay, Quentin, now it's getting uncomfortable.
Yeah, I'm wondering like he spoiler alert, he just puts a ton of feet in this and I'm wondering if he's just doing that.
If he's trolling people.
I think is probably what he's doing.
I mean, it could have been at one point sort of like unconscious and now like everybody talks about it. It's like, well, now I got to do it. It's like the Hitchcock cameo. Oh, there he is in the corner. I got to, sorry guys, I got to go stand in the corner in this scene because people are expecting it. I think he loses the thread a bit at the end of the second act where Rick Dalton has his big moment on the set of the pilot where he kind of like rediscovers the craft and Cliff, who's the Brad Pitt character, who's Rick Dalton's stuntman slash handyman slash driver, goes on a small trip to Spawn Ranch. And then they come home and they watch his episode of FBI. And then from there, it's like there's this narration by Kurt Russell where and then we get into the events of August 1969 and that night and Kurt Russell's narrating the whole thing. It's just like it seems like he's kind of like either he wasn't sure how to stage it or he was trying to skip through a bunch of things that maybe he if he wanted to show but maybe didn't have any idea about how to do it. So it like the storytelling definitely has this bump as it goes as it leaves act two and tries to get into act three. That I think he struggled with and he's like, you know what, I'll just throw in some narration and it'll be fine.
That it feels thrown in too, like when Kurt Russell all of a sudden you're hearing this voice narrate, it's like there hasn't been any narration or maybe there was like a little bit early on and then all of a sudden there's this narration.
I think there's some narration early on. I think it's before Cliff has his like flashback to fighting Bruce Lee.
Which is fun. And that's the thing, that Bruce Lee scene is fun. And I know probably people have read about it, heard about it. But I think he could have gone further and just had that scene last a little bit longer. I just feel like there's these flashes, right? And then it was back to the, it's almost like the everyday life of Hollywood is what he's trying to do. Like you're saying, he's more focused now. But it loses some of that energy, you know. And a lot of people are comparing it to Pulp Fiction, I guess, because it's set in L.A. But to me, it's not anything like that. It doesn't have that energy, or like, and it's linear. It's not non-linear, you know. It's a good. There are scenes I like a lot, but they seem to just they pop up, and then it's back to the.
I think the point of that scene is to illustrate the character of Cliff Booth and sort of like set up what he does later. in that, you know, first of all, that he had, there's this violent tendency. He's like, it's mentioned, like, we don't really get into his backstory too much. Mm-hmm. He's a war hero. It's assumed that he had killed his wife. Like, that seems to be the popular opinion. Like, she may have died in an accident, but
there's
a lot of people...
There's that brief flashback.
Right, where you don't see anything, where it's just her kind of, like, asking him a question on a boat, and you're supposed to, I guess, extrapolate there, like, maybe what happened after that.
Yeah.
But it's a scene that starts with him, like, fixing Rick's aerial on top of his house.
Yeah.
And then it goes into this flashback, and you kind of don't realize at first that it's a flashback.
Oh, you think it's really happening. Right. Like, he went back on set.
Because he hears Rick in the back of his mind saying about how he doesn't think he could get Cliff onto this pilot to be his stunt double because it's Randy, which is the Kurt Russell character, and he's had a bad experience with Randy. And this is the bad experience, is this fight with Bruce Lee on the set of, I guess it's the Green Hornet.
Yeah.
And then it goes back to Brad Pitt on the roof, and he shrugs, and he goes, huh, fair enough.
Yeah, and it's funny. Like, he's definitely a violent dude who knows how to use his hands. And I think Quentin Tarantino said he was inspired by Billy Jack, who's like an exploitation figure from the 70s, so those movies, Billy Jack movies. So he does, like... for a little bit, get the better of Bruce Lee, but Bruce Lee comes back. But I would have liked that. Just to go on along. Get excessive with it, right? Like, let that scene go on for a little while, you know?
The other part of this, too, that we haven't talked about yet is Margot Robbie as Sharon Tate.
Yeah.
Which I think a lot of people have pointed out that, you know, she does not have a big part. She's third billed, but, you know, the part isn't that big. And I was clocking it, and she doesn't even really say anything till about an hour into the movie.
She
like
doesn't,
you see
yeah.
her in different scenes,
mm-hmm.
but you don't really hear her speak until about an hour into the movie. And this was kind of bothering me at first, but you know, the more I've been thinking about it is, and there's a scene where she goes and watches herself in the Wrecking Crew.
Yeah, that's a good scene. She sees herself on the screen.
Yeah, they use the actual footage from the wreck. They don't. Like, there's a scene in the film where they insert Leonardo DiCaprio into The Great Escape because mm-hmm. he apparently worked on The Great Escape for a couple of days before they got Steve McQueen.
Yeah.
But they did not insert Margot Robbie into The Wrecking Crew. It's Margot Robbie as Sharon Tate watching Sharon Tate in the movie. And I don't know if this is, like, a level of concept that Quentin Tarantino brought to this, but we tend to think of Sharon Tate only as a victim. She was mm-hmm. a victim of the Manson family. Mm-hmm. And I would defy anyone. I think a lot of people know the name Sharon Tate, but I don't think anyone could name a Sharon Tate movie. And I think I would include me in that. I know mm-hmm. The Wrecking Crew now because it was a big part of this movie. And I think what...
Fearless Vampire Killers.
That's a good one.
I
think what Tarantino does, and I don't know if it was purposeful or not, is like try and make her an actress again.
Right. I think, and that scene, that's a really cute scene, and it shows mm-hmm. that, I think what he's trying to do is show that she was innocent.
Mm-hmm.
He wanted to keep showing her innocence, mm-hmm. and maybe having her talk would take away from that, right? Mm-hmm. Keep showing her innocence and the fact that she's a star on the rise and how she's so enamored mm-hmm. with that. She goes to the movie theater and asks if she can see it for free because she's in the movie.
Yeah.
And that's really a really cute scene, and it's cute watching herself because in that, Sharon Tate in that movie plays a klutz, and it's this really goofball comedy, Dean Martin comedy, but almost like a Jerry Lewis comedy. The way
it was during Dean Martin's goofy phase,
with all the slapstick, and she falls over, and Dean Martin falls on her and stuff, and she's just smiling ear to ear, and that's a really cute, fun scene.
And she's playing off the reaction of the crowd too. She's enjoying the crowd enjoying her.
I would have liked to see though, like Margot Robbie, like you said, has third billing on this, and really, it's not. I would say Brad Pitt and Leonardo DiCaprio, it's like their movie, really.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And she could have done more. And I'm wondering, because he wants... He, at the same time, like Leo DiCaprio's character, Rick, he's at a distance. He's a neighbor, but he's at a distance from mm-hmm. her. So I was wondering if that's why Quentin Tarantino didn't want to show a lot of Sharon Tate and Roman Polanski or their conversations.
Mm-hmm.
But I was thinking... You need something there. Like, he's next door neighbor. Maybe hear stuff over the fence while they're talking or having an argument or something. Just to give something to the character. And I think that's a valid critique that she doesn't really have a lot to say or even do, really, in this movie. She has that one cute, nice scene.
Mm-hmm.
But And then, you know, but other than that, it's like she's kind of wasted a bit.
I don't not get what you're saying, but at the same time, I think when this movie was announced, there was a big controversy. Like, oh, here's Quentin Tarantino doing the Manson, you know, the Tate LaBianca murders. And like, this is like a very touchy subject. Mm-hmm. And at the end, when you see the movie, they're almost non-presence. It's like Charlie Manson is a non-presence. And like, yeah, like the members of the family get a bigger role. And of course, yeah, like the climax takes place the night of, mm-hmm, doesn't go down as history would say. But at the same time, I think the movie benefits from sort of knowing these larger than life, real life characters. Anytime you see the family on screen, there's just this sense of like dread.
Yeah, exactly.
Because you know they are capable of anything. Mm-hmm. And the whole scene at Spawn Ranch is like this, like, it's like on a knife's edge.
Right, when he's going into the house, yeah, especially when when Brad Pitt's going into the house to investigate what's really going on there. Yeah. There's some tension there for sure.
Yeah, and one of the things I realized was that it's because in most of these scenes with the family, the background soundtrack kind of stops. Like the popular music stops and the overheard of the TV shows, mm-hmm, and the commercials all kind of stops. Because I think Tarantino, and maybe there's some reason to intellectualize his conclusion here, is like that the Manson family kind of killed an era of innocence. Mm-hmm. Like it happened at the end of, you know, 69. Mm-hmm. It was a shift in Hollywood. There was a shift in the next decade with crime rates shooting up, and, you know, yet there were more and more serial killers sort of being popularized. That's the decade of the Night Stalker and the Zodiac Killer and, mm-hmm, Ted Bundy. And it's almost, even though the film goes into like ultra violent Tarantino mode, there's a kind of regret about that too, which I found interesting. And
a regret
that things got so bad, that things got so violent.
Okay.
That, you know, maybe, I don't know, there's something to it. There's something to it that at least he gets it. Yeah. A lot of people were worried that he didn't, when the movie was announced, that he didn't get it. But I think he gets it.
Yeah, and he changed history. There's a lot of violence at the end.
Yeah.
I won't spoil anything.
Yeah.
And I think it's an amazing ending, actually.
Yeah.
And I thought, yeah, that was great. That was awesome.
Yeah.
And also, I'd say, because there were so many good scenes in it, I just felt, like I said before, it probably could have been edited down.
Mm-hmm.
But couple performances I really liked. Well, one I really liked was the child actor, mm-hmm, played by Julia Butters.
Yeah.
Who's on the set with Rick.
Yeah.
And Rick's playing the heavy now.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, he has to play the heavy hippie. Oh, he hates hippies, right?
Hates
and that's
hippies.
Another thing, too,
oh,
right?
Yeah.
It's the end of an era.
Hates
and
hippies.
He's got the big mustache,
yeah,
and the fringe jacket, and he's kidnapping this girl in the scene. But before the scene starts, she's sitting there, 10-year-old girl, and precocious, reading this biography on Walt Disney while he's reading this this paperback Western. And,
or is he?
Or is he even reading?
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's such a great scene with her, like, with her talking to him about her acting method. And
yeah.
it works really well. And then he does a good, like, one thing about this movie, it doesn't have a lot of the classic Tarantino monologues.
Mm-hmm.
But when he's acting in that scene as the heavy kidnapping the child actor,
yeah,
when Rick, played by Leo DiCaprio, is acting, that's a great monologue and a great scene.
Yeah.
And then she whispers to him, oh, that's the best acting I've ever seen. And,
yeah,
and he loves it because he can tell, like, she studied acting.
Yeah.
And even though she's 10 years old, he really takes that.
But it's about the praise, right? It's,
yeah,
like he's back on top.
Yeah, exactly.
he was again, the star of this cowboy TV show for a long time. Now he's doing guest parts. But in this moment, he's back on top.
Yeah, he's back. He's the man again.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And I would say Margaret Qualley as the hitchhiker,
mm-hmm,
I liked her a lot. I think she could have done a little bit more, but I thought she did a really good job. And drawing Brad Pitt to the ranch.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought she was really good. And Brad Pitt himself, I think.
Yeah.
It was really good because there's something there with him. And he's like one of those characters where he's got this violent past. And, you know, he seems like he's just this carefree dude. But
yeah,
when he gets violent,
yeah,
he gets really violent.
Yes. And they all lived happily ever after.
Yeah. Oh, don't spoil anything.
Well, not all of them.
Yeah.
And so, once again, those were reviews of Parasite, Joker, and Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. I hope you enjoyed revisiting them. In the meantime, we will get stuff ready for a whole new episode next week with our usual format. You can listen to the show or any episode of the show on our website, endcreditsradioshow.com. You can download it via the Guelph Politicast channel on Podbean every Friday or through your favorite podcast app at Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, and Spotify. You can find us on social media at Facebook at End Credits Radio Show or on Twitter at End Credits Radio. I will be back tomorrow at Thursday at 5 p.m. for News on Politics and Open Sources Guelph with Scotty Hertz. And in the meantime, I'm on Twitter and Instagram at Adam A. Donson, or you can check out my political site at guelphpolitico.ca. And stay tuned for more great programming here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. We will be back next Wednesday at 2 p.m. for more end credits, and we will see you then.